Welcome back to the Video Essay Podcast. I'm your host, Will DeGravio. Today, I am so thrilled to be joined by director Bianca Stichter, whose film 3 Minutes of Lengthening first hit festivals in 2021 and is now available to stream via Hulu in the United States, BBC iPlayer in the United Kingdom, and hopefully via some video on demand streaming service near you. Bianca's film is truly one of my favorite works of recent years and has been very well received by the video essay community, who have noticed a certain kinship between the documentary and the video essay as a form. One of the highlights of talking to Bianca was learning that 3 Minutes of Lengthening actually first began as a videographic essay, first created for the Critics' Choice program at the International Film Festival Rotterdam. So in this conversation, we get that kind of history, but also discuss the various videographic techniques that Bianca uses in this superb film, which, again, I hope that you will go and watch as soon as possible if you haven't seen it already. As always, you can learn more about this show at thevideoessay.com, subscribe to our newsletter at thevideoessay.substack.com, and please check out www.recycledscreenings.com to check out the latest work that is screening on our online video platform. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Bianca Stichter. I am now so pleased to be joined by Bianca Stichter, who is the director of 3 Minutes a Lengthening, one of the best films of recent years that I've seen, and just a work that has really stuck with me ever since I first watched it. So, Bianca, it is such a pleasure to have you here on the Video Essay Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Will.
And my first question is if you could just briefly introduce yourself and how you came to creating this film. How did you arrive at this project?
Well, I was I worked for a long time as a film critic at a Dutch national newspaper called, just a difficult name for non-Dutch people, NRC Handelsblad, way back when in 2014. The Critics' Choice program in the film festival in Rotterdam, they started a kind of program with video essays, and they asked me for that first time if I wanted to make one too. And at that moment, I was not watching films that much anymore. I was not really at the forefront of film criticism. So I said, I don't know, I don't have any new film, but what I would really love to do is work with this old footage that I had just come across. And they said, okay, go ahead. And that was the start of the project. And in 2015, at the Rotterdam Film Festival, I presented a short version of the lengthening. Then we got to, like, let's say, 25 minutes. But I felt that there was still much more to do. So I looked for a producer, and then we worked on it for 5 years more to get it right.
Wow, that's wonderful. I did not realize that that was the origin of the project. I've actually made video essay as part of Critic Choice, and know Dana and Jean-Peter, it's a wonderful program. So that's so great to hear.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think, you know, we'll talk more about video essay in particular kind of later in the conversation, but that's such a great story. And, you know, there's so much that we could discuss about the film, you know, the filmmaking, the story, the history. Also, Rich, we could spend hours talking about it. And I say that because I think for this conversation, I really want to just focus on the filmmaking and to try and understand how the sounds and the images and the story itself were assembled. And so my next question is, how did you go about familiarizing yourself with this footage? Because it seems to me that you know, it's only 3 minutes in length, of course, but it's very rich, dense, a lot going on. And so how did you approach watching it, immersing yourself in it? And I assume that you engaged with it in a variety of ways in contexts. And you've just explained that watching it to make a video essay is probably much different than watching it to create a feature film. So could you talk to us about how did you immerse yourself in it and come to understand it?
It's for me, it always strikes me as kind of like, funny is maybe not the right word, but interesting that although it's an old piece of footage, a lot of new technology had to be there for me to find it and also to make it, or for the story really to unfold, because I first heard about it in a Facebook post that was about a book written by Glenn Kurtz called 3 Minutes in Poland. And that was about the footage his grandfather shot in 1938 in the small town of Nasielsk in Poland. And in this post, it also said you could watch this footage on the website of the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, where Glenn had, after he found the film back, he had donated it to them, and they had restored it. If he had done that even a month later, the footage would have been in such a bad state that it could not have been restored anymore. But it thankfully was, and that's where I saw it for the first time. And for me, what was in first watching it very important that most of it is in color. And of course, the world of 1938 is mostly, if we have pictures of it, they are mostly in black and white, to such a degree that you might even think that everything happens in black and white. So that gives it a much more contemporary feel, as if these people are still somewhere on the planet today. And then especially with these kids that all, you feel like over the ravines of time, they're really looking you in the eye, they're really, really looking right at the camera. So when I watched it for the first time, my first impulse was immediately being completely in it, and then 3 minutes, boom, it's over. And I had immediately had this need, like, couldn't we make it last longer to keep that past in our presence for a bit longer? But I was not working as a filmmaker at all, so I didn't do anything with this thought until that a question came from the Rotterdam Film Festival, and then I had to dive into the deep end, and thankfully could work with a very good editor and very good sound people and a very good composer and so on. So when you're not very good at something yourself, you better surround yourself with very professional people that can translate all your, like I would always say to the editor when we were sitting, I don't know if this is possible, could we do this? And she would always say, Katerina Wartena is her name, she always say, well, we've not done that before, but we can try. So it was a very interesting process to work.
One of the things that I was thinking about in this film is it's such a great testament to the good that digital technologies can play in filmmaking, right? From the restoration to, you know, you interview in the film Maurice Chandler, who's recognizes himself as a young boy.
And also his just like me, his granddaughter of Mr. Chandler was watching the footage and then recognize her own grandfather as a 13-year-old boy. And then she was like, oh, like ringing her father, mother, and her grandfather. And he also watched online and recognized himself, which must have been a very extraordinary happening, especially because Mr. Chandler, as most Holocaust survivors, don't have anything left from that time. So when he had this piece of film, he said to his family, now you know I'm not from Mars, but I'm really from a time that and a place that exists, and here is a little bit of it I can show you now.
How did you and your team approach finding the different layers to it? Like, were you zooming in, pausing? Were you watching it in an editing platform so that way you could really get to familiarize yourself with every frame and every inch of the canvas? Like, how did you go about making sure that you were, you know, understanding and unpacking every second of this?
The first thing I did was, of course, read the book by Glenn Kurtz that has an amazing amount of information. He did a lot of research. I don't think I could have made the film if the book hadn't existed. So the first thing I did was to record a long, long, long interview with him. And we used that his voiceover in the movie comes from me interviewing him. And I knew a few things that I really wanted to do. For instance, at the beginning, just show the whole 3 minutes unadorned, only the sound of the camera. And in the end, show the same footage again, and then hopefully, because everything you saw and learned in between would make you watch it the second time in a very different way. And I think we just in the beginning we went at it, you know, from all angles we could possibly think about. I did some, you know, additional research, because if you make a something visual, of course you're also interested in different things than if you're writing a book. So I was like, I want to know everything that we see. What is it from the, you know, what kind of trees are we watching? What kind of birds are we seeing and could possibly hear? So I wanted in that way to, you know, what could we say about the type of clothes people are wearing, and what are the patterns on the dresses of the women's clothes, and so on and so on. So that you, of course, and I try to put that in the film a bit, almost going into the absurd, because, you know, we hear that there is the trees are a certain type of linden trees, and then you get this whole story about the Linnaeus who envisioned in whatever it was, the 17th century, that taxonomy system, his name was also Lin, and, you know, all that kind of bombardment with not completely relevant information to in a way stress the fact that what we really know something about, namely the people, we cannot know something about. So you're going to shoot at, you know, show in a kind of absurd overload of information, because about the really important things, it's very difficult to find information. And, you know, while you're trying to gather as much as you can, and there's also, of course, always a part of being lucky and being unlucky. For instance, I thought clearly see people speaking. So I thought, if I find a lip reader who can read, let's say, Yiddish from that area, we can know what the people said. But then we, in the end, found two lip readers who could lip read Yiddish. And they both said, No, the fragments are too short and the image is too blurry. We cannot possibly make out what they are saying. So you always have a lot of, you're doing a lot of research that doesn't bear fruit in the end. But on the other hand, we were very lucky when I went to Nashelsk in, I think, 2018. The production company rented a very good researcher who mostly works with, let's say, people from Israel or America that go back to Poland to find their ancestors, let's say. And she, I asked her, have a look at the film and everything that we haven't been able to find out. Maybe you, with your different skills, can. And that's how she, in the beginning of the film, you see that we are trying, or Glenn Kurtz is trying to find the name of that sign up from the grocery store and to read the name of the person whose grocery store it was. And then I thought also, okay, we've reached the limits of the celluloid here. We cannot possibly extract this information out of it because it just stays blurry. It is not possible to see what kind of letters there are. But then she was started to juggle and think, okay, this letter looks a bit like that letter, and that letter looks a bit like that letter. Maybe it's this, and then having the records from Polish archives and phone books and so on, then she did manage to decipher the name. So this also is a kind of, well, not a warning, but a warning in a positive way that you will never be ready with this, because if a person with a different set of skills and different kind of knowledge and different technologies looks at it, still something that we could not possibly know will be found out. So that was a very interesting thing for me that happened.
You mentioned the something about the fragility of the celluloid or reaching the limits of it. I think for me, one of the things that I find so powerful about your film is that, you know, in many ways it is, you know, it falls into that love letter to cinema kind of genre, right? And thinking about the form, but it's not in this self-congratulatory way. Like, it's in a way that respects the subject and the people whose lives that you're depicting. And I'm wondering, you know, because the research process and the fragility of film as a medium are absolutely at play in the film, but they don't overpower and overtake the story that you're telling and the lives that you're examining. And I'm wondering if how you thought about that just from on a tonal level when you were making the film. Was that something that you were aware of and trying to think through?
The fact that this movie exists is already really something, because there is not a lot of material left of a Jewish life in Poland before 1939, the Nazi invasion, and the Nazis tried to, you know, murder all the people and erase their whole culture. So the fact that this film exists and that we can watch it and still see something of that culture is already for me a very a powerful thing that very much works against that erasure, and also gives even to the smallest discovery we could do about it, gives it a kind of weight that is, you know, an instrument to counteract that that erasure. So that was a very important point for me. And of course, with this kind of material, you know, you have to also let it speak for itself. You don't need to make it sentimental, because, you know, you have to be respectfully distant a bit and not get between the watchers and the material, but try to let the material speak as loudly as it can. So, you know, it's also, you have to show restraint and respect while making it, and trust that the viewers will often have the same reaction that you had yourself to the material. And, you know, no one is unique. So a lot of people, I think, are, even if they are not living in Poland or Europe or Israel or America, but in Taiwan or whatever, can very much relate to this old footage. And there's also, of course, something strange that happens to historical artifacts. When they were, you know, when they were made, they were quite ordinary. But the longer ago it is, or the rarer the material is, it makes it, time makes it extra ordinary. And that is, of course, what has happened here. The most mundane images you could possibly see, a scene of a tourist on the street and kids trying to be in the frame, and some people looking up, a few old houses, and that's it. But because that material became so rare, because that world was erased, now it's some kind of extraordinary proof of a life and a culture that we cannot see a lot of anymore.
The film, I should mention, you've mentioned him, the original footage was shot by David Kurtz, and then Glenn Kurtz, his grandson, discovered this footage and went through that restoration process and got us here today. You begin the film by playing the 3 minutes in full and just kind of letting us familiarize ourselves and to see it. And, you know, for reasons that you've just outlined, I'm sure. And you don't cut to B-roll of the area today, or you don't have the talking head kind of expert interview. And I think maybe the only time we aren't with Kurtz's footage in some form is you have a 3D rendering based on the footage, which is really just kind of another way of engaging with the footage, right? Could you please just discuss this decision and why it was important for you to stay with the footage for the entire film?
That was the idea I had from the beginning. The footage is so strong that anything you would add to it would be a kind of diminish it instead of enhance it. I think it's also because you really are concentrating very much on something small, and also there's no way out. This is what we are going to do and going to see. So it also has some kind of more immersive kind of quality in that way, I think, that you really can have the illusion that you are in that town in 1938, which would, if you saw Talking Head, you would be taken out of that illusion immediately. And yeah, I think that, you know, just staying there also gives you the opportunity to, you know, we give a lot of information, but so it's a kind of like a detective story on the one hand, but on the other hand, I just wanted it, you know, to breathe, to just let people be with this footage, to wander around it themselves. So that was also a very important part to try to structure it in such a way that on let's say one side you have this trying to get as much information as possible, but the other hand let the viewer roam freely through the material. So that were a bit the two roads I was trying to.
I would love to understand or be taken inside the editing room as much as you can here. And I'm just curious, you know, about perhaps maybe other versions or edits of this film that you tried out, and how much of the creating of this 3 minutes of lengthening is you in an editing room with your team playing around with different things versus how much is kind of scripted or charted out ahead of time, or maybe there's a third way, and that's not the dichotomy.
Yeah, I think we didn't have a script. We would just sit, and then I had an idea, and I would write a text that the voiceover would become on the spot, and then we would try, you know, to fit it in. You know, we had all this kind of little chapters, and then you're going to try to structure it in the best way that you have a good rhythm, because, you know, the worst thing I could do, I thought, is make it boring. That would be a real disrespect to the material. So you had to find a way, you know, to find a good rhythm that you, you know, and then it's for me, surprisingly, I'm mostly work as a writer, but and of course filmmaking is, you have much more tools at your disposal, much more instruments, you have sound and music and all that kind of things to play with. But in the end, the structuring is not so different from when you just write and have letters. You know, you have to find a way to bring that beginning, middle, and end, and not necessarily in that order, in a structurally interesting way to make it an interesting experience. So, you know, that took a while until we had that right. And I think we also were doing research at the same time as we were editing. And then I went to Poland to Nashels to record the sound and to record some the Polish historian you hear in the film. And, you know, then you're just where does it work best? And it's a kind of intuitive process, I guess. But there were not a lot of things that we, you know, I had probably had much more ideas before I started to do it. But in the end, all my, let's say, more outlandish ideas didn't seem really necessary, because the film was so powerful itself that you didn't have to do too many things to it to make it speak. And sometimes it was as if the film had its own voice and would call you back like, nah, that does not seem like a good idea. Let's not do that. No. And then in the end, it was actually not so necessary to do outlandish things, except for that one element of the computer 3D rendering, because sometimes, you know, you always have to have something jarring as well. And that's the thing that people can say, you should not have put it in, or you should have, you know, that always has to be one element that gives it a bit of a kick. And, you know, a lot of young people especially, that is how they mostly see the world nowadays, through such computers. So I just wanted to play with that a little bit.
It sounds like what you're saying is, in a sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it took kind of starting to edit and make the film to really understand the film that you wanted to make. Is that correct? Like, what did editing the footage itself reveal something about the footage that you had previously not thought of? Like, did you need to, like, is how what you mentioned the footage speaking to you? Like, so how did the process of creating the film end up shaping the film itself?
Yeah, the funny thing was that, the funny thing is, when I watch the movie now at the festival or something, there still will be this image. It's like, I haven't really seen before what happens there in the upper left left corner. You know, so it's in that sense, it's never ready. I think there were a lot of things I knew beforehand that I wanted to do. For instance, that in the book, not Mr. Chandler, but another survivor remembers that they, in the cafe, you probably see they did dancing on Saturday evenings. And he mentioned the name of Bert Ambrose, which and they listened to the BBC radio. So and then you can actually look up the Radio Times from 1938, and yes, you see it's Bert Ambrose. And then you find a song that's called "Chasing Shadows," which is, of course, in this context, an incredible coincidence. And then I say, okay, can we put that song under those images, and then we have two things come that probably have been together at that time. Suddenly we can bring them together now, and that feels for me as a kind of the magic of filmmaking. And then you can edit it in such a way that it looks a bit as if the people are actually dancing to that song. Yeah, we have two songs, let's say that Bert Ambrose song, Chasing Shadows, and then a religious song by a cantor that Moshe Kuzevitsky, that Mr. Chandler remembered being in Nashelsk before the war for a kind of concert in the synagogue. And so there we did the same thing again, and you have an image of people going in and coming out of the synagogue, but we don't have an image of the interior. So I thought we can do that song there, and then we just stop at that one image of let's say between the doors of the synagogue, and you see this all those little white pixels, let's say, moving on the screen, saying like, yeah, we cannot go in, but we can let you hear what probably was played there. And then for the rest, we use a little bit of sound effects, a car door that slams close, or a sound of birds, but that's just a little, not too much, because sometimes you also really need to make the people aware again, like what we're watching is a silent movie. There is no sound, which can also be a kind of powerful revelation at a certain point. And for the rest, I worked with a Dutch composer who I had... We had used his music as a kind of temp music, and I thought, why not ask him, because his music is so perfect for this. And we had one conversation, and he looked at the film, and he said, okay, in 2 weeks I'll come back with something. And it was fantastic immediately, so I was very happy with Wilco Sterke.
Yes, and the other sounds that we hear, as we briefly mentioned, are our voices. We hear Mr. Chandler, Glenn Kurtz, and you worked with the great performer Helena Bonham Carter, who is the film's narrator. And could you describe what that process was like? Like, when does the narration come into the picture, and when you're creating the film, and how does that shape the final film, and what's the kind of give and take there?
Let's say the narration is a bit my voice, let's say, in the original 25-minute version, it is me. But everyone has his skills, let's say. So I thought it would be much better if an English person who has a great voice and is a great actor would do it. And I think she does a marvelous job. She doesn't speak like, that was for me an important point, like, you know, you have often in documentaries that kind of voice of God situation, like, we will tell you everything from high above. But I wanted her more to be, you know, be on a journey of discovery herself, not just one step in front of the audience, because we did the research, but not some authority from up high who will tell everyone how it is, but more a little bit more modest. And she, of course, can also convey it with a lot of clarity and empathy. So I was really happy with that.
And you mentioned the original 25-minute version of this and how it had your own voice. And, you know, I want to return to kind of thinking about video essays, because, again, we are on the video essay podcast. And as we were talking about before we recorded, creators of video essays have noticed a certain kinship between this documentary film and kind of the work of the video essay. This has appeared on the Sight and Sound Magazine annual survey of the best video essays in 2021 and 2022. I just want to read quickly here. Kevin B. Lee, who's a friend of the show, renowned video essayist, in writing about your film, called it, quote, an impressive array of videographic techniques to create a vast and deeply moving contemplation on lives lost and history reimagined. And one of the things that, you know, that informed the creation of this podcast was the fact that the term video essay is very loose, and there are all sorts of artistic traditions that influence the video essay, you know, found footage filmmaking and documentary filmmaking and essay filmmaking. And I'm wondering what you make of this film being compared to the video essay and as a form. And I guess we already know that you had a general familiarity with video essays, but what was your awareness of that?
Well, yeah, it started out as a video essay. And then, yeah, some people call it a documentary because it's a non-fiction film, and I call it an official essay. So, yeah, it's just labels that, if people want to call it a video essay, that's fine by me. I don't, very familiar with that genre. I haven't watched a lot of video essays myself, so I couldn't, for that reason, I cannot say, oh, this is absolutely a video essay. But if other people want to call it that, that's fine with me.
Were there films of any kind? You know, we often get so obsessed with labeling when it's, you know, it doesn't really matter. But were there films that you were watching or had watched before creating this film that inspired, is like maybe the wrong word, but that you know, helped you think about the kind of film that you wanted to make?
Of course, Shoah is, of course, because of the subject matter, and also because he did it also in a very specific way, by mostly focusing on people speaking, so quite the opposite of this, in a sense. What for me was an important film, let's say, maybe not so much for watching it, but for knowing about it. The name of the guy, the Rose Hobart. You know, Joseph Cornell. Yeah, that was for me the first time that I really thought, okay, so you can make a film from film. That was a revelation to me, that you could actually, you know, use a film and create a completely different film the same material. So that was, in that sense, the most, as an ID, the most important one for me, I think. In that time, it must have been really, really like a brain eureka moment. Like, oh my God, this, you can actually do this.
And you know, we're coming to this conversation. The film has been, you know, out in the world for a couple of years now, or maybe a little, you know, coming on 2 years. I know in the United States, it's streaming on Hulu and is available to rent and all of the various places. So I would just be curious for you to describe in general what the response has been to the film. And I would be particularly eager to hear from, you know, what the response has been from, you know, survivors and their families.
I think, well, overall, amazingly, positive. You know, you make something yourself and you think it's good, and then you think, I'm not that extraordinary, so probably there must be other people who like it too, you know, so you're never sure. So it was the premiere was in on the Venice Film Festival, and that went down very well, so that made me very happy that this story can now be, this film can now be seen by so many people. And of course also the Mr. Chandler and his family, I think, were happy with the results. And in London we had the premiere, I think, in November on the Jewish Film Festival. And then one of the other survivors who Glenn interviewed for his book, he has passed away now, so he couldn't be there, but all his wife and his children and grandchildren all came to the first night, so that was very, very, very special. And one of his daughter, I talked to her later, and she said that it was for her, you know, a strange experience to have a story that's first was just something that her father would tell, the story about the cutting off of the buttons, and now suddenly it's, you know, in a movie and people all over the world will hear that story that for me was just a kind of story for my family. And I understand that must be a strange thing happening, that something which first is really private and now it's suddenly it's something that a lot of people you don't know can hear of. That's also the power of the film, I think.
Bianca, thank you so much for joining the Video Essay Podcast. I really appreciate your time, and thank you for making this film. It's remarkable, and I hope everyone listening, if they haven't already, will go and watch it.
Thank you so much, Will.
Today's episode was hosted, produced, and edited by me, Will DeGravio. Emily Subin Co. is the show's associate producer. Music by Ketza. For more, visit www.thevideoessay.com.